Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey everyone, welcome back to the show. This is our second to last episode before the season ends and Sagar and I take next week off. As I mentioned, last week we had technical difficulties, so two interviews got cut short. Firstly, Sagar and I recorded a back and forth discussion episode that you guys all know and love. And then secondly, I recorded a conversation with Mark Leibovitz of The Atlantic about his new book about Trump's Washington, Thank You for Your Servitude. He'd also written a book back in 2013 that was really foundational how Sagar and I thought about D.C. and Washington. It was called This Town, and it was just really interesting portrait of what D.C. looked like right before the Trump era. Can't recommend any of these things more than that. So here's the way you should consume this episode. We're going to combine the parts of the Sagar Marshall episode that were available with the part of the cut short Mark Leibovitz episode. So hope you all enjoy that. And once again, apologies for any of these technical issues. A quick note, since we're nearing the end of the season, this is a good time to shout out that we have our Supercast, of course. Yesterday we released a Q&A episode that's available exclusively for subscribers. If you'd like to submit your questions and also support the show, you could subscribe to The Realignment at realignment.supercast.com. Hope you enjoy this episode and see you tomorrow. Hey everyone, welcome back to the show. We've got our discussion episode coming out on a Thursday instead of a Friday because we had a bit of an issue with a recording that I did yesterday. So I'm going to have to mesh around with it a bit, but we'll be sure to have that out on Friday. Want to do a quick plug for our Supercast. We are nearing the end of the season. Sagar and I are going to be on vacation at the end of the month. So this is one of our last chances just to plug the chance to support the show. $5 a month, $50 a year. $500 for a lifetime membership. You get Q&As. You get to just support the show out of the goodness of your heart. But you also get extra content of those bits. Sagar, can you throw a quick plug and then we'll get into the actual episode?
Yeah, look, we ask for it because we need it. We want to be able to take this show as independent as possible, finance our costs, do the expansion, editing. It all costs money. So look, if you're able to, it means a lot. And as I've explained to people before, because I think people don't understand that it's not just like a donation that disappears into the ether. If you help out, and if you, especially if you sign up for those yearly or lifetime memberships, the ability for planning purposes to realize cash, I cannot tell you how useful that is as a business whenever you're especially dealing with a recession, trying to hire people and trying to plan. So if you're able to, it means a lot. I think people should be more upfront in the content business of like, this is what you're paying for. Editing costs, production value, like that stuff. If we realize it early and if we realize it now, especially, you know, dealing with churn, recession, economy, so helpful. So please do it.
Yeah, that's realignment.supercast.com over link in your show notes. And it's Sagar, something I'm actually pumped to start doing is Austin actually has a huge number of guests and folks who roll through, and you'll be coming through in the fall a couple different times. So I want to start doing more in-person recordings. Once again, though, that's
there's
another
some great
studio
cost.
There. Yeah. There's actually a great.
Crystal and I did one there. It was awesome. I'll send you the contact info. But actually, here, again, open kimono, it's $500 an hour, just so people know.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's not cheap.
Yeah. So that's an example how we're going to be really stepping it up and going there. Once again, realignment.supercast.com if you've not checked it out already. Okay. On to the episode. We're going to go down the line. Let's start with a really interesting topic. There is a new New York Times Siena College poll that basically is doing a full deep dive into the American political system right now. And there's two parts of the poll we wanted to pull out. The first one would be 58% of Americans right now think we need major reforms or complete overhauls of the political system. Sagar, I want to just get your specific reaction to that point.
Yeah, I mean, the democracy point of it is probably the least interesting part of the poll to me, if that makes sense. So we're going to be talking later about the class divide, education, Trump, Biden, age. Those are all far more interesting. I mean, in general, people have been non-institutionalists now for at least 10 years, and especially in the way that they're expressing themselves. I also think that what libs and others underestimate is when right-wingers say they have less faith in our democracy versus liberal, they're not saying the same thing. they're saying completely different things. And that doesn't mean that they converge on a set of policy solutions. It just means that people are pissed off, which no shit. I mean, if you point to the poll, 90% of the country says that everything is on the wrong track. But people should not take that as a policy prescription for like, wow, X percent of the American people are ready to abolish the Electoral College. I'm like, yeah, that's not what that says. I just think people need to understand that.
Yeah, and to be fair to the New York Times, which we don't do that often, the poll and the write-up of the poll, we'll link this in the show notes, is very specific about it. So there are two different issues that are driving.
I'm saying the way people read it, not what they said. I have no problem with what they said. I'm glad they did it. It's a useful, it's a useful metric.
And what they did was they basically said, if you are to the left, your real beef with the status quo in terms of government is that it seems like a government is not able to actually accomplish what goals you want to have. You are the type of person who sees that Democrats have won more than 7 national elections for the presidency when it comes to the popular vote, yet Republicans have obviously won the presidency far more times than that. You look to the fact that Supreme Court justices were appointed during those specific times. And then you see the fact that, you know, the very big decisions, whether it's climate change, gun control, and then abortion, obviously are being overturned by that court. So once again, I'm not necessarily agreeing with that critique. That's the left version. The right version, and this is the version which I think it's easy to understate how concerning this is. The right version is basically election integrity. Is basically like, we do not think that elections are, it's pretty straightforward, right? It's in the poll that we don't think the elections are valid. And this is the type of issue that comes up in terms of 2024. We'll be covering this issue a little later, but what's always difficult about the election integrity section is that it's very easy to just feel like, oh, by talking about this, like, are we being cringe? Is this Morning Joe? Are we just being MSNBC? But it's a genuine issue. And I think what makes this poll interesting from our perspective, Sagar, is the left critique and the right critique are both ones that establishment politicians on both sides actually have to answer. I think that's the difference between this and 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe. I mean, at the same time, how do you answer it as a Republican politician? They're not asking for anything. They don't actually care about voter ID. You could pass voter ID tomorrow and Trump would still say the election was stolen if he lost. It's like, and I mean, even the Democrats, it's like, well, what could they really, outside of, let's say, the extreme shit, Electoral College, all of that, what do you want? Some fake voting bill, which quote unquote guarantees people the right to vote, which actually, if enacted, like in Georgia, wouldn't really do much except on the margins, like plus or minus 10, 15,000 votes. These things just all seem ridiculous to me. In practice. But, and you know, everybody uses doomerism language. Remember when everybody was convinced that Florida was going to go blue forever because felons could vote? It's like 30,000. It's like, yeah, guess what? Ron DeSantis is probably going to win. So, you know, it's like every time I see these things, I just think everybody's being so dishonest. And it just doesn't matter. I mean, what do Republicans really mean? Okay. So the people who are listening to this, who are Trump supporters, I'm just going to call you out. You don't give a shit about voter ID. You don't give a shit about mail-in ballots, any of that. And to the extent that you do, it's only because functionally those things may work against your side. And even if they don't, you've just been told that. And so that's what you believe. You can throw all the data that you want at me, but I know that it's fake. And this is why whenever people talk about it, they use euphemisms. Look, I don't disagree. I think it looks like we're a third world country whenever we're not able to just call election results immediately. But the alternative to that is having a non-federalist election system, that seems way worse, and also which not something that you would do anything
don't
about.
Want.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Like that's. But yeah. Okay. Quick thing, because we need to make this point very clear. So there's been this increasing meme on the right of wow, during this post, basically early 2020 COVID era, it's taken longer and longer and longer to return election results. So you've seen these examples of wow, we're a third world country. This country can't function, this, and that. You're basically suggesting that one of the immediate responses to that is, okay, you're right. It's because these random rural counties and these poorly run states can't do it. It's time for the US Department of Elections. I think that's what a like even good faith center left person could respond with. And the right voters you're talking about would not like that.
Yeah, it's like, wait, so you want the Biden DHS, which is the one who is responsible for this, to run federal elections? I actually don't want that. I think it's a good thing that states run their own elections. I think it's cool that Oregon has all mail-in balloting and then some states run it the way they want. Good. I support that. So, and actually leads to more small D Democratic input into what voting laws look like across the country. So again, I just come down to the fact that I think this entire conversation is fake. I don't give a shit about, to be clear, I don't give a shit about voter ID either way. I don't care. You know, I don't even think it would make that big of a difference. Either way, the people who are claiming it's racist, you are ridiculous. The people who are claiming that this is going to
I'll push on this. Right?
Okay, go ahead.
Look, this is, and once again, people are getting mad, but I'm just going to say it. There have been numerous instances of Republican elected officials literally stating out loud that they think the voter ID is going to reduce racial ethnic groups who would vote against them from voting. So,
yeah.
My point is, like, I think it's one thing to argue that, like, at the end of the day, voter ID doesn't actually result.
Yeah, that's
in
what I'm
racist
saying.
Results.
I'm not saying that they're well, this is the funny thing. Their impetus is all they always try. This is like the Georgia law. When everybody actually crunched the numbers on the Georgia law, it wasn't going to do a damn thing in the way that the libs were being apocalyptic about it. But the problem was that the impetus is they actually did want less people to vote. They were like, we don't want black church groups like handing out water in voting line. I'm just like, shut the fuck, like, Jesus Christ. The way that all of this is. So anyway, the conversation around this drives me insane. Most of the people who claim they want, quote, safer elections, if it helped Republicans, you wouldn't be saying that. You'd be arguing exactly the opposite. And I think everyone on this is completely full of shit. By the way, I actually think the GOP would be better off if they expanded voting as much as possible, because non-college educated voters, as indicated by the New York Times poll, are the least likely to vote and also currently the transcendent part of the coalition. But there's a deep paranoia that goes into the GOP psyche on voting that probably goes back like 25 years used to wanting to win a popular election, if that makes sense.
What's interesting about what you're saying is it makes me think that the real dividing line on the right would basically be, do you believe at the end of the day, the system works? Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, you clearly believe that the system works. And if you don't believe that, like, let's put aside metrics, you're not going to be satisfied with basically any reform that would go. And then look, we saw this, we'll switch to the left in a second, but you know, we saw this during the January 6th stuff. Like, remember all the Republicans who were like, if they don't object, their voters will not be heard. And if they're heard, it's going to make this difference. Like, if you want to object, like that's your decision. I don't think anyone felt more heard. And then things like felt better after that fact.
Well, that is bullshit. Again, because they were supposedly objecting on behalf of Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania's representatives were not objecting. So it's bullshit. Again, and it's like when Texas, remember the Texas lawsuit, the Texas attorney general suing her about the electoral? This all happened during the election. I don't, you know, blame you for forgetting all this. Texas sued on behalf of Pennsylvania's mail-in balloting laws. It's like, this is all just bullshit. Like, it's none of it was rooted. And this is also why I didn't go anywhere, by the way. It's all just messaging in order to massage Trump's ego. So yeah, look, every time I see people start talking about this, I'm like, look, to the extent that you can address GOP concerns on this, it just has to be Trump being like, okay, it has to just be like Trump winning an election. They're like, oh yeah, this election was totally secure, 100%.
And what's interesting about the left end of this, though, right? So I get your point that in the short to medium term, it doesn't matter what Democrats think about expanding the electoral, expanding the size of the court, changing the electoral system, term limits on justices. But let's look at the lesson from abortion. There are 50-year projects. And I think what's actually happening right now is a very interesting Overton window shifting debate around those topics. So if you could think of the right in the 1970s, the right is responding to the liberal Warren and Berger courts and saying, okay, we're going to take this 50-year project to reverse those results. And as of a few weeks ago, that project worked. What I think is happening on the left is a very huge debate where you're really not seeing a particularly convincing set of answers from the more establishment, older parts of the party. So it's like, all right, let's just play. Let's play, I don't want to say lefties in the sense of like Jacobin or like the Nation Reads, but we're just generic, like 20 something, like left leaning liberals. What do you think is the argument that would convince me to not support overhaul of the system from a long-term project perspective? The GOP keeps winning. The system is so unbalanced. We need to dedicate ourselves to changing this. So, right, we're not doing any magic. So this isn't a, like, if you vote next week, this will change. Like, no, just like, I don't see how Nancy Pelosi doesn't tell a lefty, oh yeah, no, like, we're just going to keep things as they are. And eventually we're going to win again.
I think I would say that the mindset that leads you to conclude that is exactly why you can't win the Senate enough to enact those proposals in the first place. I think that, yeah, I would just say, like, if you're already in a doomer mindset, then you're not going to win the, look, if you guys want to expand the Supreme Court, then win 60 votes in the Senate. This is not going to happen. If you're talking about expanding the Supreme Court, abolishing the Electoral College, you have to just learn how to win in Louisiana, in Arkansas, Nebraska, in, what was it, Indiana? I mean, there are all kinds of places where you have to go and try and win a bunch of elections in order to try and get any of these things done. Even if you had 51 seats. By the way, there's not even the Democratic votes to do this. So you really would functionally need around 60, even if you nuked the filibuster in order to get a lot of this stuff through, because it's not like the entire caucus even agrees with you. So I would just look, I think in the immediate term, you just got to focus on learning how to win an election. And if you master that, you actually can accomplish some political goals.
What's so interesting, and I want to make this clear, especially for younger listeners, like, we have this guy, Armon, who helps with the show, with our YouTube stuff. And he, I bought him something and I needed to know his date of birth. And he was born in 2002. So wow. Typing that in,
I was like, that's wild.
Yeah, I was like, post 9/11. So I think we should give the context for this. Democrats have won 60 seats before. You know, Arlen Specter was a Pennsylvania
Republican. He probably doesn't know that. Yeah.
Arlen Specter was a moderate Republican. He switched parties. So it's, they didn't win 60 seats, but they got to 60 seats. That was Barack Obama's 2008 Democratic Party. Now, because there's a diverse listenership, like, if I were to just say Democrats should look like they looked in the 1990s and should look like they looked like in the 2000s. Obviously, that's me putting my finger on some very specific policy debates. But at the end, so I'll put that to the side. But the key point is that was a coalition. They could get to 60 seats. That was a coalition that not only won the Electoral College, but also won the popular vote. And I think your point here is that what the accelerationists, what the Overton window shifters are basically not giving convincing answer on is, okay, then why did Joe Biden win in 2020? Okay, then why did Obama's much more moderate in 2008 coalition work and your coalition doesn't work? And, you know, we spent some time dunking on the right part of the audience. So not once again, an extreme part, but look, let's focus on the left extreme here. Turning this into the DNC stole everything is also not an effective argument, because I was talking about this with Mark Leibovich. He pointed out, you know who the DNC supported in 2008? Hillary Clinton.
Hillary, yeah.
Barack Obama also won that campaign too. So there's just this really difficult dynamic where none of this is sexy. Do you know what I mean? I feel like that's like the biggest issue on both sides of it, where, and I think you always come back to this when we're talking about electoral politics, you're like, you just have to win elections. And that feels unsatisfying, but there's something that's very centering about that idea. Rather than have this, and once again, people should have debates, especially in intellectual circles, and we host podcasts, so like, we're not going to disparage that. But which is more important for the Democratic Party right now in, you know, 2022? Is it coming to a consensus position on expanding the Supreme Court? Or is it, hey, how do we minimize losses in the Senate? It's pretty obvious which one we feel that
just
one is
so simple.
On.
I don't get, you know, no, I do get it, which is that they're fools and they don't actually think about power. They're so captured.
Can you explain what you mean by that? The power thing.
Yeah. I mean, I was saying with Crystal, she's talking about the court illegitimate. And I said, okay, then win 60 seats and do something about it. It's like, I don't care. Like, you could talk all you want. You operate within the system that you're in. How do you accomplish the goal that you want to win more seats in the South? Until you do that, you're just talking. And she even agreed. She was like, look, you're right. You know, and to be fair to her, she at least acknowledged, because I was like, hey, and by the way, the person most likely to take advantage of a nuke filibuster are going to be the Republicans. That's actually how you end up with like a national ban on abortion or like all kinds of, or like the marginal income tax rate for the top 1% at like zero. That's actually, that's the functional effect of what nuking the film. And she was like, yeah, that's fine. I'm okay with that. But most of them aren't. And they need to, you know, at least she's honest. They're not honest.
Why is she?
Yeah.
Why is she okay with that?
She's okay with it. She's okay with it to the extent that it would mean that at least Dems could govern similarly whenever they were in power. So that she was okay with the idea of the yo-yo. And I was like, well, personally, I think that's kind of destructive to institutions and government policy. And like, you know, that's kind of the whole reason that I'll go to the, so this is the story. When Jefferson was not in the country whenever the Constitution was being written. And so he was in France. And so he came back and he's having like a tea with George Washington. And he was like, why did you have a Senate? Because Jefferson didn't really like the Senate because he didn't like the idea of a bicameral legislature. And Washington said, why did you pour your tea into your saucer? And he said, to cool it. And Washington said, just so. As in, the Senate's responsibility is to cool the passions of the public and allow for deliberation. Now, again, I get it. The filibuster's not in the Constitution, but it's an effective extension of the idea that some things, despite having popular presidents, FDR and court packing, that sometimes there should be people who are insulated from broader public opinion and be able to stand up even to FDR, who was effectively the king of the United States, and say, no, this is a terrible idea. And that's what happened. They killed that. Also, this happened many times in American history. The Senate standing up against overwhelmingly popular Republican sentiment this at the time decided not to actually kick President Andrew Johnson out of office for removing a cabinet secretary by only like one vote too, because they were like, hey, this would actually be a terrible precedent in American history to set. By the way, they were correct. And they were ripped by the capital R Republicans at the time. They're like, you're betraying Lincoln's legacy, all this stuff. And they were, yeah, just ruthlessly hammered in the press. There's been a lot of times like this that the Senate has stood up against. And by the way, they made the right decision in many of these calls. Now, they've also made the wrong decision many times. So you can point all this out on slavery and all these other things if you want to. I'm just pointing out, like, it was designed functionally to prevent yo-yos within the system.
Yeah, and two things, then we'll get to the next part of this topic. But my immediate reaction is yo-yos sound terrible.
Yeah, it sounds terrible. I agree. I was like, I don't
know. And what I want people to think about from a historical period is we look back, man, like, you know, the 90s were pretty great. Man, like, let's put aside racial issues for a second. 50s were pretty great in terms of like stability and confidence in American society. Those are periods of consensus. Those are periods where there's a bit of stability that a foundation can be built on. Now, the obvious critique of the 1990s is that you had this moment of like history's over stability and nothing was done with it, but that's a different critique. And I don't think anyone would like living in a world where every 2, 4, 5 years, there's just this radical shift. There's just this like real destabilization. And, you know, people, you know, say this podcast has kind of gotten squishy, but as I've thought about this more and more and more, I'm just like, you know, all I just want a degree of stability that one could build something off of. You need to have clash. You need to have conflict. I'm not going to always be someone who says you always need to have everything be stable and chill. But if we're just looking at all the problems that we're going to get into during this episode and that we talk about during the podcast, the inability is to have a stable foundation and the fact that we basically haven't had one for 20 or 30 years clearly seems to be what people are talking about when they say that we need major reforms or overhaul. Because to your point, what they basically mean when people say that is, wow, the status quo is just not working and we are getting increasingly aggressive about what we think needs to have happen. And then the second thing that I'd add here, and this is always my response to folks who, this is more to left side of the aisle, people who are doomer on these questions. I would like to see, I'll be convinced that extreme reforms are needed when you have examples of effective, talented politicians effectively not working, in the sense that, you know, LBJ, talented politician, JFK, talented politician, FDR, talented politician, Bill Clinton, all we, like, there are examples of are under the current system, under the current post New Deal status quo, you've actually been able to govern. And a lot of the time, people's excuses for why that isn't possible, oh, like the polarization's too high and, you know, there's extremists and this, this, and that, I think is kind of, it's just kind of cope for the fact that politics is incredibly difficult. And, you know, people knew that I became the Biden stan on this podcast, especially towards the start of the year. And that's because of the fact that during 2020, Biden, as a talented politician for that specific moment, had a real pulse. His staffers tell him to take out Thomas Jefferson because he's a slave owner. And Biden's like, no. Most other Democrats would have agreed with that.
Yeah, they would.
Biden had no interest in Twitter when Twitter destroyed the political careers of countless Democrats up and down the ballot. He had these skill sets, and then he won the election. That is the point. He then appointed a Supreme Court justice. There's an argument to be had that he should have been the Democratic nominee in 2016, not Hillary Clinton. Until those facts just aren't in front of us, I'm just incredibly skeptical of the doomer version of it.
Yeah, I don't disagree. So,
next,
be good at politics. Obama was really good. You could actually blame him for. Anyway, that's a whole.
Oh no, this is helpful though, Sagar, to your point. And this isn't really Obama's fault because he tried to pressure Ruth Bader Ginsburg to retire, and he can't literally force her to. And I suspect the more he'd pushed it, the more likely she would have just not done it, to be honest. If she'd retired, this issue would have been this entire issue in many respects would be different.
If she had retired, Dobbs would be the law of the land. People forget this. Dobbs, the actual law by Mississippi, was 15 weeks, I believe.
Yeah.
That Roberts literally wrote that that's what he would have done. So then it would have been 5-4 and we would have had 15 weeks. And yeah, people would have freaked out, but like, let's be honest, like there'd be no total ban. So there's the person solely responsible for complete and total abortion bans in several states in this country is Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And people should really think about that.
And that's my point. If we can literally pinpoint one specific individual choice as the root cause of what's causing people to feel doom, I'm skeptical that the response is radical overhauls of the system.
Yeah.
What I'm more inclined of is, well, look, I don't think RBG is ever going to happen ever again. Now that we've learned this political lesson. But seriously, like I think the next time a elderly justice tries to make a very personalized, I'm going to wait for my term, I don't think it's going to work. The public outrage would effectively force them to stand down, is just what my take would be.
Hope you enjoyed the cut short discussion portion. This next section is my interview with Mark Leibowitz about his newest book about Trump's Washington. We also discuss This Town, his previous book about Obama's Washington. Hope you enjoy the conversation.
Mark Leibowitz, welcome to The Realignment.
Good to be here.
Let's start by describing something that I'm sure is going to be a little confusing for guests. What exactly is your beat as a reporter?
Oh man, that's a great question. I've gotten that for years. I mean, politics generally, I mean, at least for the last 20 years or so, I started out as a technology reporter for the business section of the Post. And I lived in Silicon Valley before then. So that was my first kind of run in journalism. But yeah, I mean, I was a political writer for the style section of the Post. And if you know anything about the Post style section, it's sort of a featurey kind of no holds barred, or, you know, as no holds barred as you can get for a daily newspaper in the nation's capital was. And then I moved over to the New York Times and was just sort of a Washington reporter covering national politics. Like, there were a lot of us, but I did do, you know, I did have a sort of a different style than most people. I mean, I focused on larger features. You know, I could be a little offbeat. They indulged me more at the New York Times than I ever should have probably been indulged, but I was, you know, willing to make it. I was lucky to make it work for me, and they made it work for me. Then went to the Times Magazine and was basically the political guy for the Times Magazine from like 2012 to the pandemic. And then I kind of went back to the Washington Bureau and, you know, tried to cover the 2020 campaign, which wasn't much of a campaign as far as like being there. So that was a weird year. And then it kept getting weirder. And I guess eventually the end of last year, I moved to the Atlantic. So, I mean, my beat is politics, but it's just, it's kind of distinct within politics. It's not, I've never been like a full-time campaign reporter or congressional reporter or White House reporter or anything like that. I guess political features is kind of generic, but, you know, I've had pretty free reign, which has been a real blessing, but yeah, so that's a real mouthful of way of sort of explaining what my beat is, I guess.
So. The question will immediately come to listeners' minds when they purchase the book, because I kept thinking to myself, why are all these people talking to you? So I get it in this town, right? So this town is your 2013 book. You're speaking to a lot of C-listers and D-listers. At that point, any press is good press if you're, you know, Kurt or something like that. But if you're Lindsey Graham, if you're Trump, well, let's put Trump aside for a second. If you're basically most of these A-list political Republican players, there's zero upside to speaking with you. So why does it happen?
You know, I've been getting that question for years, even when, I mean, you know, I was doing pretty some A-listy stuff, like I remember my first big piece, really, my first political profile for the Washington Post was in 2002, and it was on John Kerry, and, you know, basically became a two-headed profile of John Kerry and his wife, Teresa Hines, and they were getting ready to run for president, and she was a big personality, a very wealthy personality who, you know, was bankrolling a lot of it and wanted to be sort of treated as an equal, and they acceded to a joint interview, and, you know, it was, I think, seen as it was a very memorable piece, but people sort of saw it as a disaster for Kerry. I mean, I thought it was sort of a fun story to write, but you can judge for yourself. But and that sort of put me on the map, and I don't know why, but it didn't scare other people off. I mean, I think part of it realistically is that I was attached to a big, powerful institution like the Washington Post, then the New York Times. And, you know, so it helps to have a big affiliation behind you. And the other thing about politicians is, more than like, say, if you're a real estate executive, I mean, part of your job is to be out there, right? You kind of have to be known. I mean, you're certainly allowed not to talk to people like me, but when you're a public figure, you got to come out in public a lot, theoretically. So, you know, and these are also, I mean, Donald Trump is, I mean, he sort of subsists on publicity, and that's sort of been his thing for his whole life. And Lindsey Graham too. I mean, he loves cameras. So, I mean, you can appeal to vanity to some degree, and, when I wrote a book about the National Football League a few years ago, and now I got the same questions, like, and you know, it was a little different equation there because they didn't really know me, but you know, all these owners who usually, these billionaires who don't usually talk to people, they sort of said, oh, here's a guy on TV, he talks about politics, because, you know, they'll occasionally see me on like Morning Joe or something, and they figure I must be kind of in a different category than these sports writers they deal with. But I don't know, man, I assume, you know, everyone has Google. They know, they can know what my work is and make their own decisions. But, you know, I hope they keep talking to me.
It's interesting because, once again, the focus of this book is obviously the Trump's Washington, especially from the Republican Party's perspective from 2016 to 2020. But it seems to me, from a pure, what are you trying to do from a political perspective, cutting off access to everyone from the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal on a bad day would seem to be one of the first orders of the day. If you're going to say, we're going to break up the media, we're going to not break up the media, but basically break up the status quo. I think there's a weird version of Steve Bannon who probably would think that'd be the right move. So it's just interesting that access continued unabated.
Yeah. I mean, there's a school of thought that definitely subscribes to that. I mean, it's much of the Republican Party. I mean, Ron DeSantis isn't exactly talking, I don't think, to my old colleagues at the Times. And I think there was just a big profile of him in the New Yorker by Dexter Filkins, which seemed to spend months on. I don't think he talked to him. I think he avoided him. So I think, you know, a lot of the Republicans, I mean, this has been happening for years, but or building for years, but Donald Trump really made it a much more sort of dangerous place to be a mainstream media person. I mean, we became the enemy of the people. It was a much more menacing environment. You know, we were bad. We were corrupt. We were evil. We were very bad people. I mean, you know, he painted us with as broad a brush as he did a lot of his, you know, any of his enemies, which can create kind of a dicey environment. But look, I mean, there are ways to do this job without access. I mean, if it's access dependent, you're kind of in some trouble. I mean, you got to be resourceful. There are a lot of ways to get access without, you know, without people knowing. I mean, you can just, again, watch people's speeches, study them, talk to their friends, talk to, you know, people who know them, just report around it. So, you know, eventually, hopefully the picture comes into some focus.
That's just interesting because when you're talking about the Trump enemy of the people thing, he says that, yet he's Maggie Haberman's texting buddy, yet he's chatting with you. So you pointing out that DeSantis is taking that strategy to its logical conclusion, which is if they are your political opponents, you also don't talk with them. This upcoming election is going to be an interesting testing of this theory taken to its logical conclusion.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Trump is a very special category here because, you know, on one hand, he creates his own weather system and can, you know, really, he can tweet or he could tweet. He can do whatever. I mean, if he wants attention, if he wants to say something, he can say it. But he really also just needs the sustenance of the New York Times, of the media. He really needs this stuff. He cares about the approval of these people that, you know, have not accepted him. I mean, it's a classic kind of Trump nose against the glass. Everyone looks down on him. You know, he needs the acceptance of the mainstream institutions, whether it's the Manhattan real estate, you know, community, whether it's the New York Times, whether it's, you know, smart people, whatever. So, so it's a pretty, I think, unique pathology to him. But no, I hear you. I mean, it's a weird balance and everyone does it differently.
We're going to kind of jump all over the place, but what you just said made me think of something a little later in the podcast script, which is the idea of what rules apply, what rules are invalid, and what basically has been reshaped after 2016. Because what's interesting is some of the people who you're profiling in the book, you don't really cover Madison Cawthorn. You mention him, but Madison Cawthorn is the example of someone who sees Trump and says, hey, there are no more rules. I can do this, 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 and that.
Yeah.
Doesn't turn out too well for him. So there is some degree of there still being some rule outside of Trump specifically. So can you just talk about this idea of how you've seen politicians navigate a space where they see themselves as having more ability to break norms, quote unquote, than before?
Yeah. I mean, I think Trump has spawned, you know, a whole cast of imitators, some more successful than others. But I mean, Matt Gaetz, Marjorie Taylor Greene. I mean, just the entertainment wing of the Republican Party is, as they're known, like to people like Paul Ryan. I mean, people who just thrive on attention. It's just all a communication strategy. They don't even bother hiring policy advisors and so forth. It's all just, it's like what Trump does. It's just, it's all about getting the attention. It's all about pushing the outrage meter to the next level. So, you know, I think it's a kind of a depressing trend. It's not a lot of fun to watch. But, you know, I remember after Trump won or even during the 2016 campaign, you know, he did shift some paradigms in a very fundamental way that I didn't think were necessarily for the worst. I mean, I think he didn't really care about fundraising that much. I mean, part of it was, you know, he had a lot of money himself, but he didn't throw a lot of his own money into the campaign either. I mean, he basically subsisted on free media and the media was a willing partner for that. You know, Twitter's free. And, you know, once you're the front runner, I mean, the free media is going to come from every direction. So that was his campaign. And it was, he was, I mean, I spent a fair amount of time with him early on, at least in late 2015. And he, it was just him and Hope Hicks and a couple other people. And, you know, the world came to him. So, you know, if you're someone who makes enough news and who people care about enough, I mean, you can do that and not spend a lot of money. So I thought, you know, maybe that was going to upend, you know, the fundraising industrial complex a little bit. Maybe it did. I don't know. But, you know, he was able to do some things that were sort of broke out of the orthodoxies of what you would expect a Republican to do. I mean, also, you know, he was trashing the Iraq War. He was trashing the Bushes. That wasn't something, you know, Republicans vying for the nomination were doing at that point. He wasn't necessarily, you know, talking about abortion all the time. He wasn't going to mess with entitlements. So there was a lot of what had been taboos within the Republican Party, even from a policy standpoint, that he was very happy to break and really paid no price for it.
Yeah. And the key political question at individual level is, are you as a no-name backbenching congressman or woman able to replicate that same strategy to success. Marjorie Taylor Greene can. Right. Right. Madison Cawthorn cannot, and it's really the gap is really where the main rub is. Another question that just, this is actually the first question that I wrote down as I was reading the book today. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about American politics after writing this town and then this book put together?
I would say pessimistic mostly. I mean, these are rough times. I mean, I'm not one of these people who thinks that it's overheated to say that, you know, our democracy is really fundamentally at stake in some ways. I mean, I do, you know, when this sounds kind of Pollyannish, but, you know, you talk to young people, you meet enough smart, interesting, diverse, you know, thoughtful, you know, active people who are sort of seeing the world and seeing their role in the world in a very dynamic place. And that can't help but give you hope. But I mean, there needs to be some, I mean, you know, the Republicans at this point have the system. I mean, they have some real built-in advantages that they seem to be perpetuating, whether it's, you know, the court, the electoral college, the Senate map. I mean, you know, the fact that 500,000 people live in Wyoming and they get two senators, and, you know, DC doesn't get one, Puerto Rico doesn't get one, California gets two, even, I mean, there's all those, you know, there, however many senators are represented, you know, so there's all that. And then, you know, they've busted norms. I mean, you know, Democratic president needs a Republican Senate in order to get a Supreme Court pick through. I mean, like, you know, if Republicans win the Senate and 2 weeks later there's an opening, I mean, I have no confidence that Joe Biden could get another seat there. And I mean, it's a bizarre thing what they've been able to do. But there's that. I mean, changing the voting election rules. I mean, a lot of these sort of bad actors who came about after Trump lost, these election deniers are getting jobs. I mean, so there's a lot of really systemically problematic things standing in the way. But I mean, you would like to hope that the will of the people and the churn and the, you know, ferment of generational change can ultimately transcend. But it'll take a lot more activism than I think exists today. So I don't know if like that's going to, I don't know what direction that's going to go. But I mean, so, you know, just again, knowing the people I know under, say, 40 do give me a great deal of hope. And, you know, it helps to travel more. I have not traveled much since the pandemic, like most of us. And, you know, that is always an eye opener just to go to these, you know, bright red communities and see, okay, kind of similar to a bright blue community. I mean, I do. In some ways, you know, Barack Obama's 2004 convention speech about the things that unite us and, you know, the goodness of people. I buy that. I bought it then and I buy it now. But I also think that there's just a lot of poison that's been put into the bloodstream over the last number of years that makes it really hard to trust and love, you know, fellow Americans. And, you know, so I do worry about a lot of that.
It's really interesting that you're saying you are buying Senate candidate Obama's 2004 speech, because I think the line that would probably stick out to most, you know, I was back in middle school when this happened, but like even the line that would stick out was, there isn't, like, you know, a blue America, there's not a red America, there's the United States of America.
Yeah.
It seems to me that when you're talking about generational change, that idea seems to be the idea that's much more up for debate, especially within the Democratic Party. Because it seems like the Republican Party is already imbibed that, which is like, look, this is, you need to win.
Yeah.
You get your justices through, you do this, this, or that. And the question really, and this comes to the debate around Joe Biden, if we could get into, is does Joe Biden's, let's say, I think Joe Biden still believes in the United States of America, but I think amongst younger Democrats, that style of rhetoric falls short. So how do you just think about that dynamic?
You know, I see both sides. I mean, I think people who, I think Biden, I agree. I think it's genuine. I share it to some degree. Maybe that means I'm old, but I think that's the only way it's going to work. I don't think one side is going to be able to overpower the other side in the great red blue civil war here. I mean, yeah, the Republicans led by Trump have really, or even led by McConnell before Trump, or Gingrich before McConnell. I mean, they have sort of adopted a real blunt force approach to politics. And I think, you know, the non-Biden camp in the Democratic Party would wish that Democrats would do that too. I don't know how you reconcile it. I mean, I do think probably the best solution ultimately is some kind of compromise, is some kind of cross kind of party, cross-generational, cross-racial coalition that, you know, Obama was able to, you know, put together. I guess Biden sort of was able to put together, if you sort of, you know, you could sort of look at it that way. I mean, Trump, it certainly wasn't a cross-racial coalition, but he got a lot of Democrats. I mean, he his supporters were largely whites, and, you know, working class whites were his base, but a lot of them were Democrats. So, I mean, I guess he did broaden the Republican coalition to some degree. I mean, he lost a lot of suburban Republicans. So I don't know. I mean, maybe if, like, the people on the left who are not Biden and who take a more impatient approach, maybe there's just such a wave of them, and there's so many of them, and they will be so energized over Roe, over what's happening. There'll be some kind of a whole series of precipitating events. Maybe they just won't be ignored. But again, I mean, the die's being cast pretty methodically, I think, by you know, the courts, by the state legislatures, by, you know, Republicans in the House and Senate, especially if they win majorities.
I think what's interesting here is it's interesting that your book comes out a few weeks after Roe v. Wade was overturned. Mm-hmm. And it adds a degree of, to be honest, difficulty mm-hmm. when it comes to critiquing Republican elected performance from mm-hmm. like in terms of how elected officials performed in right. regards to Trump from 2016 to 2020.
Yeah,
because looking at Trump's, because as you know, the final argument that Ted Cruz and more like traditional conservatives settled on mm-hmm. towards the end stage of the 2016 primary was he's a faker. He's mm-hmm. lying to everybody. He's yeah. this New York guy. He's going to get in, and then he's going to do the equivalent of appointing Harriet Myers to the Supreme Court. Right. So that's what he's going to do. Right. But he didn't do that. Right. And I'm curious why this would be two questions, basically, in a second. I'd be curious why you think that scenario didn't come about. But the point is, he ended up basically, he actually said, give me the list. And then he did it.
Yeah.
And then he pushed through with Mitch McConnell's support. So it's just hard for me to basically critique the Republicans as cowards mm-hmm. because
they got a lot of what they want.
And I am very skeptical that they actually could have gotten the job done. I'm skeptical that any Republican but mm-hmm. Trump could have beat Hillary Clinton in 2016. So how do you just think about that dynamic of like the cowardice versus just like, this is politics?
Yeah, that's perfectly valid. I mean, there was I remember after he won in 2016, there was a whole school of thought that the reason conservatives, you know, evangelicals, you know, were so enamored of him was that he was their murder weapon. I mean, you know, he basically, you know, managed the ultimate defeat of their uber enemies. I mean, Hillary, but just the left. I mean, all the right people were mortified that he was able to survive and win. And yeah, they got their judges, they got their tax cut. You're 100% right there. So, but they also lost the Senate, they lost the House, they lost the White House. They lost a lot of Republicans to retirement. They lost a lot of Republicans demographically. If you look at party identification, you know, people under 35, I mean, Republican, I mean, it couldn't be lower. So, I mean, you know, I think, and then there's, I think some of them would say that there's been a big psychic price. I mean, I think if you were to put a lot of Republicans in the House and Senate on truth serum, I mean, they're not convinced that the America of Donald Trump that was so deranged and divided and just so chaotic was the way to go and sort of trending us in a good direction. So, yeah, I mean, I think from some very basic levels, though, yes, the murder weapon was aimed to great focused benefit for a lot of these Republicans.
Something I'm curious about, we were just hinting at this a bit with the brewing Democratic based dissatisfaction with the status quo. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, I'm curious what you think about this part. What the past 2 months revealed to me is that the mistake that Bernie may have made was thinking that the Democratic base discontent was going to come from economic issues, when it mm-hmm. seems to me there was much more energy on the cultural issues. And the failure to deliver on those senses. I've just noticed that AOC, and maybe this is just the Twitter circles I hang out in, like the Instagram circles I'm in, has gotten much more traction when she's talking about Democratic failure to codify Roe v. Wade than when she's talking about the Green New Deal amongst people who vote in Democratic party primaries. And then she's making this critique against Nancy Pelosi versus the sit-in. So mm-hmm. I guess the question would be, is there any world where you see a Democratic equivalent of Donald Trump? In the sense, put aside the crassness, the, you know, shoot someone on, you know, Madison Avenue, like that wouldn't happen for like demographic, economic, and like cultural valence reasons. Someone who basically says the Democratic establishment has failed so bad for 10 years that you need to go with me. So what mm-hmm. a Mark Cuban could say, a Matthew McConaughey could say hypothetically, like, what do you think about that dynamic?
It's possible. I mean, I think it's hard to sort of assign anyone a Democratic Donald Trump role, you know, while sort of separating it from the pure malignancy of the guy. I mean, I think, you know, I don't know if that was part of the appeal. It probably was in some ways, but I mean, you know, he's a dark guy. He did some really dark things. I think he exceeded a lot of people's expectations of how bad he could be. You know, you would realize it's hard for me. I mean, he basically ran as a villain, right? He ran as a villain for everyone except for working class white people, angry white people, right? I mean, in 2016, and it wasn't a broad coalition by any stretch. So I think, you know, AOC is, I mean, she's certainly a controversial figure, but mostly because of her politics, and maybe her style is not to the liking of everyone, but she's not a malignant actor. I mean, she's one that a lot of people disagree with. She's one that people think is way too progressive and misguided, and you know, she certainly attracts a great deal of dislike, but no, I see that. I mean, someone, I think Democrats, I think anyone's susceptible to a Mark Cuban or to someone who can bring a sort of paradigm shifting approach to this. I mean, I think, look, people, Democrats especially, just want to be electrified. Barack Obama was the full package. I mean, he was both electrifying, he was new, he was different. He had a new coalition he was rooting for, and, you know, he was competent. I mean, it was amazing. I mean, I guess, you know, Donald Trump was similar in that he electrified the right. And, yeah, I don't know if AOC could sort of reach beyond the left. That's sort of the question. I mean, you know, and you do, unfortunately, you need a broad coalition to get elected, you know, especially if you want to win states like Ohio and Florida, Georgia, Texas, that kind of thing.
So I guess the real question, and this is what a Bernie listener in the audience is wondering, is why, and I'm not alleging, I really don't like when people do the DNC destroyed Bernie conspiracy bit, because no, he just only got a third of the primary votes. Sometimes the unsexy answer is true, which is that his coalition was not a winning coalition. But what this basically gets at, why was the Republican Party vulnerable to a takeover from an outsider candidate? And in a way that the Democratic Party was not, and I think largely still is not.
Yeah, it's hard to know. I mean, you know, the Republican Party, firstly, yeah, you're right. And he did it. I mean, this whole book that I just wrote, you know, it was about Donald Trump identifying weakness in an entire political party and a bunch of people and just exploiting it and driving right through it. So and Barack Obama in his own way was quite a disruptive force. I mean, you know, the Clintons were basically the establishment at that point, and lo and behold, he came in and beat them. I mean, you know, and he brought young people in. He, you know, had a cross-racial coalition. He had a few Republicans, independents, one place like Iowa, at least, you know, in the caucuses. And so that was disruptive. I mean, you never really know what the disruption is going to look like until the disruption is sort of happening, you know? I mean, no one saw what Bernie was going to do, but that had a lot of mileage. So,
Yeah, that's interesting, because I think let me put it this way then. It seems to me that Trump exploited a couple of different things in 2015. So one, the policy points that you pointed out, which was there was a gap between the way GOP establishment elite saw the world, right? So
yeah,
Iraq, foreign policy, immigration questions, that's a huge one. There were those policy gaps. There was just the narrative gap. You know, we had Senator Rubio on the podcast, but I was just always thinking back to, I don't actually know a single person in the country who is thinking, man, I just want like a next generation, like Republican voter. It seemed like in that narrative level, he was actually like taking like Democratic style JFK, Obama, Bill Clinton influence, like
young Rubio? Person.
Yeah, Rubio. Yeah. And yeah. Trying to, so that wasn't a real narrative. Like no one really wanted a Bush. And then the final one was there was just the, talk about this then. The weak, I like use of the word weakness, because weakness could mean a couple of different things in this context. Like what weakness did he perceive?
He thought that they were all vulnerable to him. I mean, he played by different rules. He didn't play by rules, right? He thought that eventually, you know, he could just smear Jeb Bush up and down the debate stage. He could talk about Ted Cruz's wife, and you know, suggesting she was not attractive. I mean, saying his father was somehow involved in the Kennedy assassination. I mean, this is just no holds barred stuff. And so, I mean, yeah, what could they do after a while? I mean, he exploited weakness in the system, but like, look, I mean, if you got 40% of a rock solid Democrat or Republican base, I mean, that's what you're going to do. I mean, you know, if Ted Cruz really had a backbone, Marco Rubio really had a backbone, they wouldn't have endorsed him. They would have like said, nope, not doing it. And they would have held on. But like, of course, they needed to play within the system. They had to think about next time. They all expected, well, after Trump loses, I want to be the next in line. So they all were expedient in that way. You know, remember in all the debates, in the Republican debates, even at the beginning and also towards the end, they'd have the question, all right, will you raise your hand to commit to, you know, to supporting the Republican nominee? And Trump never raised his hand. He never raised his hand. He's like, why? Why should I? And like Ted Cruz, I mean, I remember there was this one debate, I think in Detroit, where Cruz, Rubio, Kasich, and Trump were just going at each other. I mean, they were just going right at Trump. I mean, it was brutal. They were accusing him of everything. He was coming right back. It was one of the ugliest debates ever. And then whoever the moderator was, you know, did the raise your hand thing, and they all sort of raised their hand and Trump didn't. But I'm like, oh, okay. So they're all going to support the nominee. So they're basically playing the same old game, and he's not, and he doesn't care. And to me, that was weak on their point. I mean, like if Ted Cruz was really as exercised as he sounded, genuinely, same with Rubio, you know, they would have stuck to their guns. I mean, Rubio was going to retire from the Senate. He was done. I mean, he spoke in the most, you know, just harshest, but also the most dispirited terms ever at the end of his campaign. You know, he was retiring from the Senate, like enough. And then, you know, he said, oh, wait a minute, where's my parking space? I need to be somewhere after November. You know, Ted Cruz, you heard his speech at the Republican convention in Cleveland. I mean, it was a pretty ballsy speech. He, you know, vote your conscience. I mean, okay, there are worse. I mean, everyone was like, oh, what a disaster. He was booed out of the arena. I'm like, it wasn't a disaster. I mean, there are worse things to have on a bumper sticker or have on like a, be associated. And, you know, that lasted a few weeks because, well, Hillary Clinton would be the most disastrous president. And so, you know, he went back to that form. So I don't know. I mean, to me, that's a sign of weakness. It's a sign of just being bound by your opportunism and bound by your orthodoxy. And Trump was happy to exploit that. So, hey, can I just inject? I have, actually, they're telling me I have a 3:45 and I probably have to jump at like 3:40. So
yeah, no problem.
Yeah, so I have like a good one at three. So I have another 10 minutes or so.
Yeah, no worries. So, yeah. I guess what's hard here, and I think this is my pushback as someone who read the book, is why are you assuming the opportunism is purely cynical? Because as we know, Trump appointed three justices. So yeah. I think the obvious pushback would just be not merely that Marco Rubio wanted a parking space, but you wake up in October and you're like, okay, given the set of very high stakes situations. So like, it's not the 1990s is basically what I mean, in the sense that like American politics is clearly up. So like, so here's the real question. To what degree do you think they are truly, to what degree are people driven by their ideals? Because I could just see a way of like, my ideals are just so certain on these court related questions. You know what? He said my wife is ugly. I'm going to suck it up.
Right. I'm so pro-life. And now we have, you know, Roe v. Wade's overturned. So it's been worth it to me. Yeah. I mean, I account for that being a possibility. I'm not so cynical as to say, oh, yeah, it's all opportunism. I my pushback to you on that is, you could be right. I mean, I think you actually probably are right. And I think if you're sort of looking at this as a purely bottom line exercise, I mean, these are very big, concrete things that they got. And I think that, you know, that should never be discounted. But I also am cynical enough to look at the likes of Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio and Lindsey Graham and know that there's something beyond that, just because they have changed their, I mean, look, if you can flip flop fundamentally on a person like Donald Trump, I just sort of look at the whole record. So I don't expect that their motives are pure, but I don't discount either that they're sincere about their beliefs and have this to show for it. So yeah, I would say you might be right.
Yeah,
maybe we're both right. I don't know.
Yeah, and I think that's the weird answer. Because the pushback against me is they all thought he was going to lose. So if you thought he was going to, this wasn't like, man, like if I don't endorse him, this all goes down in flame and I'm responsible for our cause losing. Right. So that's the confounding variable. So, okay. Last quick few questions. So, and I know people hate hypotheticals, but I'm genuinely curious what you think about this. Yeah. So I think of the Ted Cruz thing, you know, your wife, ugly, your dad killed JFK.
Right.
What if Ted Cruz had punched Trump in the face on that stage?
Oh man.
Because we're talking about disruption, right? Like there are no rules. Anything basically goes.
Yeah.
What do you think could, like, once again, I know it's hard to know for sure, but just talk about the dynamic of what that could have introduced.
Yeah. I mean, could have gone any number of different ways. It would have been, first of all, I'm glad it didn't happen because it would have just been weird as hell. I mean, I don't know.
That's the most honest answer.
Well, I just think it would have been weird. I would have been like, wow. I remember like the Will Smith thing. I mean, when things like that break down in like not good, not civil, violent directions, it's just not a good thing. So, you know, someone would have, I assume he would have gotten some, hey, attaboy, and like, oh my God, he's out of control. Isn't this awful? I mean, remember when, I guess in that Republican Senate debate in Ohio, when Josh Mandel like stood up and I guess confronted the other guy and they were like face to face for a bit. And I remember Trump actually critiqued that. He said, that was weird. Like, what was he supposed to do? Was he going to punch an old man? And like, or even Trump himself, like Mr. Professional Wrestling, like sort of did his theater critic thing thinking like, that was weird. You know, I do the hypotheticals I think about, like, or the counter, or like, I think about like, what if Mike Pence really had been hung? God forbid. Like, would that be disqualifying to Donald Trump? I don't know. I don't know. You know, what if he did shoot someone in the middle of Fifth Avenue? I mean, disqualifying? I don't know. Someone unearths an Instagram post of the victim at a Black Lives Matter rally. Maybe he's a Bernie supporter and then Fox gets a hold of him. I mean, it's a pretty, I'm not for anything that will perpetuate this nihilistic viewpoint at all. But, you know, unfortunately, Trump has gotten away with progressively, just things that are just astonishing that he's still walking around, you know, politically viable with. I mean, the insurrection being probably the most towering example.
So a quick comment and then a last question. I appreciate your use of just the word weird. Because it's actually just a good way of really thinking about it, because like there's the movie, because people bring up the punching in the face thing all the time. And to your point though, thinking of the Will Smith incident is probably a better way of thinking about this, because there's like the movie version of this where Ted Cruz punches Trump across the face and everyone just goes, oh my God, like Ted Cruz, like he is a man, like he is a real person, but that's not, the camera doesn't pan away.
It'd be one thing. Weird. I mean, it would need, I don't know. It just, I think the overwhelming reaction to something like that is, ooh, that's just weird. Yeah. Like remember actually Chris Rock, I think said, what was that? He was just, there was like a, his first reaction was not so much like being appalled or being in pain. It was just, what was that? You know, so I don't know. I think it's hard to sort of get beyond that original weirdness hurdle.
And this is the key thing. And this is what's helpful. Trump has the instinct to know how to react to that properly. He would have had some liner, this or that. So last cue, and I just want to get your thoughts. So you wrote a big piece in The Atlantic just on thinking that Joe Biden shouldn't run again. He was the candidate for 2020, not for 2024.
Yeah.
What should folks do with that? Basically, if you've spoken to a lot of like young, ambitious Democrats,
sure. Yeah.
What are they doing with that?
I mean, you know, now a lot of
the narrative, I'm not pretending your piece is the narrative's there out there now.
Yeah, sure. Look, I mean, it is up to Biden. I mean, you know, and, you know, he has every right to run again. I mean, it's not our job to, I mean, it's not our right to say, all right, you're too old. We're going to impose an age limit and we're going to pass a bill that says once you're 80, you can't be president anymore. You know, I don't know. I mean, I think, unfortunately, the Democrats, to some degree, are just as much hostage to Donald Trump as Republicans are, in that the stakes are so high of losing to this guy that they're just terrified of risking anything but the known entity. I mean, Biden was the known entity in 2020. He was the guy that could win. You know, he did barely. And, you know, it's like, well, because the catastrophic alternative still is sitting out there, we must do the same thing again. You know, so the thought of actually throwing this open and having Gavin Newsom or AOC or Stacey Abrams or whoever, you know, primarying him, and then actually voting for that person, you know, is a scary thought, because, you know, wow, what if we screw this up and there is a less known entity than Joe Biden? I mean, Joe Biden's safety is his superpower. You know, I would argue, though, that his pinnacle was after he won the first time, maybe the first 6 months of his administration. And then, unfortunately, he had to govern in the environment that he's governing in now. And it looks like he's in quite a tailspin. So I don't know. I mean, look, I wish it were an easy fix that the Democrats had. I mean, I wish it were an easy fix that the Republicans had. But I think right now, I mean, unfortunately, you have the candidates that are going to run. So
I think that's a great place to leave it. I think the book in general is a good exploration on either side of like what happens when politics are actually high stakes, where it's not, I think, to your point, Pollyannish or hyperbolic to say that. And there's a lot of individual politicians who are going to have to make a judgment call on how they respond to those situations. So, Mark, this has been really great. Thank you for joining me on The Realignment. And I loved your NFL book too. So I really recommend everything you've written.
Fabulous. Well, thanks for having me. This was a great conversation. I really appreciate it.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.